You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. When veterans return home from duty, they can face countless challenges as they transition back to civilian life. One of those is navigating a tricky job market.
But a new bipartisan piece of legislation being unveiled today aims to address some of these challenges, as well as addressing some pressing needs in the state. This new program encourages veterans to become farmers by providing resources to them and their families.
Joining us now to talk about the bill is Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point. Senator Teston, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
And Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Senator Teston, where did this legislation working to help veterans get into or stay in agriculture come from?
Well, sure. This idea actually was brought to us by Representative Goyke's office, and it's based off a model that West Virginia used. And really what's aimed to do is to encourage veterans to go into agriculture for a number of different reasons. When you take a look at the state of Wisconsin, this is also a workforce development issue. We've got about 69,000 farms in the state of Wisconsin, with the average age of our farmers is in the upper 50s. And so we need to make sure that we're developing pipelines for people to take an interest in ag. And I can't think of a harder working group of individuals and veterans to do just that.
And Representative Goyke, what do we know about employment obstacles for veterans? Why is it important to create a pipeline like this?
Well, I think what Senator Teston mentioned, the work ethic, the training, the discipline all come natural to our veterans. But understanding how to start a career in agriculture might be a daunting task for somebody that didn't grow up on a farm. It'd be daunting for me personally as a resident of the central city of Milwaukee. And so my neighbor as a veteran might be interested in, you know, sowing the seeds and being a farmer and ought to have the state giving access to how to start that career, giving mentorship on how to be successful in agriculture.
Senator Teston, you represent an area around Stevens Point, and I'm guessing that there are more people who have grown up in and around agriculture there. Are you hearing from veterans in your area?
Yeah, I mean, I've pitched this idea to a few veterans back in my district, and they think that it's a great idea. But going back to what Representative Goyke said, what I really like about this bill and what it can accomplish is that, obviously, in my district, it's much different than Representative Goyke's district. I come from a more rural area of the state, whereas Representative Goyke comes from the Milwaukee area. But what's great about this is that you're seeing a boom in both urban and your traditional rural farms. And so this is going to help veterans, especially those who live in more urban areas, to develop some of the urban farms that you're seeing pop up in some of our more populated centers.
We've been talking recently on the program about some of the challenges in getting into agriculture, staying in agriculture, and it seems like there are a lot of obstacles. What specifically are you two hoping to offer to veterans who are trying to get into agriculture? What support?
Well, the bill itself, the structure of the bill requires our Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection and the Department of Veteran Affairs to work together to identify veterans in agriculture that exist, that are existing veteran farmers, and help them as well as those interested in starting a career in agriculture. I mentioned earlier providing mentorship, providing resources on how to start or how to improve, how to make their farm more efficient. And the other component that the bill does is it creates what we call a logo type or a seal that the farmer is a Wisconsin veteran farmer. If the listeners think of a label they may see on products that says something special from Wisconsin, something you may see in the grocery store, we're creating in this bill a similar logo type that would verify that the produce is Wisconsin veteran farmer grown. And for me as a consumer, I then can direct my dollars to support these initiatives, and the farmer benefits from being able to boost their produce in the store.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue of financing? Because that's something we've heard from especially young farmers. They can't get the money up front to be able to buy their own land. They're, you know, it's an expensive and risky business to be in, even when you know what you're doing. What kind of options might there be for helping with loans or any kind of subsidies?
The bill that we're introducing today doesn't have financing attached to it, so it's not an expansion of loan eligibility or doesn't have a pocket of money associated with it. But I do think what is important in getting DATCAP and WDVA to talking to one another is leveraging resources and benefits that both veterans and farmers may be eligible for, getting those agencies to talk to one another so that veterans going into farming or that are existing farmers understand what options and what programs are available in the state. I don't think these two agencies are talking to each other in this context yet, and that's one of the major outcomes of this bill that we see as a positive.
And to kind of piggyback off that, really what we aim to do with this proposal is to encourage the UW system, the extension system, to, you know, for veterans to help them with employment, mentorship, and outreach opportunities to really show them that there is a great opportunity in ag. Because the other factor that we have to discuss is that a lot of times when veterans come back from overseas and doing their time in service is that they have wounds that some are visible and some aren't. And there's been countless research shown that farming is a great way to help reduce things like PTSD and other some of those things that aren't visible from their tour of service. And so I think this is a great opportunity. We've seen a lot. There's been a lot of success with this program over in West Virginia. When they implemented this program in 2014, they currently have about 250 veteran farmers now. And other states are taking a look at this model as well. There's about 13 other states, and I think Wisconsin should follow suit.
We're talking with Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point and Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee. They are introducing today a bipartisan bill that will try to support veterans who want to move into agriculture. And it sounds like in some ways solving two problems, really, Representative Goyke, because veterans need the access to good jobs and jobs that suit sometimes their special conditions. But this is also helping one of the largest industries in the state.
Absolutely. And listeners may not realize that I'm an urban guy. My entire legislative district is 3,600 acres. So it's smaller than maybe some farms in Senator Teston's district. But we are growing food in the city, and urban agriculture is a growing – that's a terrible word to use, but it's a growing field in my hometown, in my backyard. We have some incredible dedicated veteran service organizations in the heart of the city of Milwaukee, and I see it as an awesome pipeline to get guys, even on a small scale, into urban agriculture and connecting the food that we grow locally with food service jobs, food preparation jobs. It's a growing industry. We all eat. We all like food, and it's a great way to interject veterans into that workforce, into that pipeline, growing food, making food, selling food. And I think this is a great start to do that, whether it's in the central city of Milwaukee or in the most rural parts of our state.
Well, and it also seems like sometimes in those very urban areas, there's also the other food issue, which is not having a lot of access to healthy, fresh food. And so maybe if those veterans are farming within the city, that can also make it to the neighborhoods that need that food.
And I can just attest that the neighborhood grocery – I have one grocery store in my entire district. And me personally, I have to drive to a suburb to do my grocery shopping, my family's grocery shopping. I'm dreaming of seeing a veterans farmer stand, a fruit and vegetable stand maybe at a farmer's market in the central city or a special section for veteran-grown produce in the central city of Milwaukee, because you've absolutely hit on a need in my community for better access to healthy food. This is potentially a great pipeline for that.
Senator Teston, how many veterans are you hoping might benefit from this legislation, the programs it would create?
Well, based off the West Virginia model, I mean, after about 3 years of being implemented, they've got about 250 veterans who have taken advantage of this program. My hope is that we can reach those same levels as well. Because going back to what you touched on, I mean, the ag industry is such a pivotal foundation for our state's economy. I mean, last year alone, it was an $88 billion industry. It made up 11% of our state's workforce, and that doesn't even account for the support industries. So if we can develop that talent pipeline and get in a younger generation of hardworking veterans who have sacrificed so much already to give them the support that they need to pick up the torch for agriculture, I think that's a win-win for the state.
And what about the families of those veterans you're hoping to move through? Representative Goyke, I'm from an urban area myself, so some of this is not second nature to me, but my understanding is it's hard to run a farm without the whole family kind of being involved.
Absolutely. My mother grew up on a dairy farm in De Pere, and she ingrained in me in an early age not to go into farming. And it was because when she was a young girl, she was out milking cows and doing the chores before the sun rose. And yeah, that was absolutely right. They were eight kids and all hands on deck 24/7, 365. It does take a family to run a farm, and I appreciate that you've highlighted this question. The bill does extend access to this type of programming and mentorship to the families of our veterans, as well as families of veterans that have lost their lives in combat. Mm. And so we intentionally are making it reach beyond the individual veteran himself or herself, but to also include their families.
And Senator Teston, what kind of response are you getting from your colleagues?
So far, the response has been pretty good. The more that we talk to folks about this proposal, the more people seem to buy into it. And so this afternoon, we're going to hold a media event in the Capitol and to continue to build awareness and build the coalition around this idea. And so I suspect this is going to have broad support across party lines because this is by no means a partisan issue. This is about helping our veterans. This is about supporting a foundation of our state's economy. And this is a common sense proposal that I think everyone can come to the table and agree on. This is a good idea.
And Representative Goyke, in an ideal world, when would we see this actually put into place?
Well, I'm optimistic that we can get the bill passed. As Senator Teston said, it's a bipartisan bill. We've done our due diligence in the months of this session to ensure that the state agencies have been at the table and that we're creating something that can be implemented and doesn't get lost or it doesn't create more bureaucratic hurdles for our state agencies that will be implementing this. So I think once we can get it signed, we'll be up and running, and then the mission for us will be to measure its success and ensure that we grow and continue to give the resources to the people that are out there growing food.
Well, Representative Goyke, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Senator Teston, thanks for coming in as well.
Happy to be here.
Senator Patrick Teston of Stevens Point and Representative Evan Goyke of Milwaukee joined us to talk about a new piece of bipartisan legislation that was introduced today that aims to help veterans become farmers in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A UW-Madison student got a photo assignment for an elective class and decided to use it as an excuse to visit and document some of her favorite spots on campus, libraries.
Elise Shimke joins us to talk about her project. She's from Stevens Point, Wisconsin, and is a senior at UW-Madison studying history and English literature. Elise, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks.
So how did you come up with this really creative idea?
So I had an assignment for my photography course this past semester, which was to create a typology. And a typology is when you go around and photograph the same object or theme in different settings, and then you can take those different images and draw conclusions about the commonalities and differences between them. And I had originally tried to do payphones.
Are there many payphones left?
There are not many payphones left. I found about five in the Madison area before I kind of like gave up. So I was thinking about new ideas, and I came back to this idea that one of my professors in a previous semester had touched on in an English like design course about campus architecture. He had taken us around campus, pointed out different buildings, and asked us to think about how we could compare what buildings look like to the information inside them and the people inside those buildings. And I thought that was a really interesting idea, but I wanted to capture that idea in a more visually consistent way. So I started thinking about parts of the buildings that might show those commonalities and differences like that. So as I was thinking about it, I realized, that pretty much every department or major on campus has a library associated with it. Libraries have fairly consistent structures. They have shelves, books. So that's where I kind of went with it and took it off.
So initially you thought, I'll find payphones, and you could only find five around Madison, but then you decide to do libraries, and I'm guessing there were a lot more libraries at UW-Madison than you imagined.
Right. If you ever go on like a campus tour for like prospective students, that's one of the kind of fun facts that tour guides will bring up is, oh, there are X number of libraries on campus. Of course, I didn't remember that exact number, but when I went back to look at it and counted it up, yeah, there's 41 in total, which is just was a bit overwhelming.
Wow. So can you give us some examples of the interesting or unexpected libraries you discovered doing this?
Yeah. So some of the really interesting ones I found, the first ones that come to mind are like the zoology research stacks. It's a closed collection, but it has just a lot of neat information on biological topics. And then the Ruth Kettner Harris Design Library in the School of Human Ecology has just numerous works on just both like textile design, like and things like that. And it was really interesting to just flip through some like old magazines and look at like fashion in the 1950s.
And so 41 libraries, how long did it take you to go and photograph each of them?
Right. So when I started the typology assignment in September, I only photographed like 9 libraries to begin with. And that took me a couple of days to get those together and then to edit them. Then when I revisited the assignment at the end of the semester, because I was looking for something to do for a final project, and this seemed like something to expand upon, I actually asked my sister at one point, I was like, do you think I should do this? And she was like, no, that's way too much work. You can't get that done. So I was like, well, now I have to do it.
Just to prove you wrong.
Right, exactly. So I had a lot of final projects kind of going at that same time. This one was just particularly just nudging me in the back of my mind. So I was like, okay, I'm going to set aside a week and I'm going to finish it. So I made a series of post-it notes that broke down the libraries based on geographic location and then the hours that they were open. Mm. So every day, if I wasn't in class or at work, I would take a post-it note and I would cross off all those libraries on that note. So after a week or so, I had them all done. I wasn't as enthusiastic as we got to the last couple of post-it notes. My feet got rather tired, but yeah.
You talked about it being a typology project, so there was a theme to how you were photographing them. What did you decide was the look that you wanted to have consistent through these different photos?
Right. So as I was going to the libraries, each library had at least like 2 bookshelves within it. So that seemed to be something that I could keep consistent. But, you know, if you're just photographing down the center of two shelves, that's not very interesting. So I realized also that each of the libraries would more than likely have a chair in it as well. And the chair seemed to bring back a little bit of that idea of campus architecture that I had originally been thinking about when I started the idea. So I dragged the chair between the shelves, and that had this nice kind of like vanishing point that was completed then. And then as I was going about that and had evolved into the chairs, I realized after like 3 or 4 libraries or so, and the libraries that I had visited were like science and math based. And as a not at all science and math based person, I had never been to these libraries and realized I wasn't going to recognize them later on. So I was looking for ways in which I could kind of make notations as to which of these libraries I had been to. So when I went back and edited, I could, you know, see where these were and make note of it. So I started like dragging books or, you know, decorative items that I found in the library into the photo as well so that I could have that marker and see like, oh, this was the physics library. But then as I looked at them more, especially like one that I had taken in the limnology library with just this like massive like fishing net, those photos started to become more interesting than the ones with just the chairs. So it kind of evolved into finding what bits of information within the library I could bring into the picture. And that information a lot of times was more than just books and taught me a lot about kind of how people conceive of information in different ways.
So what kind of response have you gotten to your photos?
It's been an extremely overwhelmingly positive response. I've been shocked and really encouraged by the positive reaction people have had to it. it's been really rewarding to hear from like alumni across the country that'll send me little notes saying, oh, I used to work in the library, in the chem library in the 90s, and I remember, you know, teaching the librarians like how to put like barcodes on the books or things. Or this one woman commented on Facebook and was talking about how she and her husband met in college library in the 70s, or like that is how, you know, the place that they spent all of their time. Wow. And it really brought back memories. So, yeah, it's been really powerful.
And you've actually turned it into a book that you're selling on Etsy.
Yes, yeah. So that's taught me another lesson in kind of just like small business management. Wow. And given me some of those skills as well. So it's taken on new layer after new layer.
Well, as we wrap up, Elise, do you now have a new favorite library as the result of this project?
That is a hard question. There are so many good ones. I don't know. Just like, I guess there's some visual ones that'll always stick with me as being favorites. Like the, I believe it's the Max like Kata Institute. It's the German library on campus. It just has some really beautiful chairs, of course, in it. And then just incredible artifacts as well. When I went there, I was lucky enough to be able to look at some letters from a man, I believe, that was running for some political office in the late 19th century. His handwriting was, or his letters were written entirely in like crosshatch.
Wow.
In German. So even if my German was well developed, I would have had a hard time reading them. But it was cool to hold that history.
Well, Elise, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
You can see some of the highlights of Elise Shimke's photo collection, Libraries of UW-Madison, on the Central Time Facebook page and on WPR.org.
Between 1996 and 2015, the number of working-age adults claiming disability nearly doubled, from 7.7 million people to 13 million. Rural areas in particular are seeing a significant jump in people turning to disability benefits.
But what's at the heart of the increase? The Washington Post recently published its investigation into the matter and tried to determine if the people on disability were injured or trying to survive in places where jobs had disappeared.
Terry McCoy is a social issues reporter for the Washington Post. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what drew your attention to this issue? Why disability?
Well, I was thinking about writing about poverty. I write about poverty in the United States, and most of my focus has historically been on urban communities. But with the result of everything that has happened in the country politically, we really wanted to focus a lot more on rural communities and what's happening there, what are the issues that are driving the politics in these areas. Specifically, what drew my interest to it was the repeated claims by then-candidate Donald Trump that there were, you know, sometimes he said there's 25% of the population was unemployed, or as high as 47% of the population was unemployed. And I really wanted to figure out why he was saying that, why was it resonating so much? And what we found was that in a lot of communities in which there are extremely high rates of disability, folks on disability aren't counted in unemployment statistics. So kind of clarified a couple of those things that questions that we went into this with.
And you take us to this family in Alabama who many of the family members are in disability. One in particular is really conflicted about whether to apply for disability. Take us to Alabama.
So I went to Lamar County in northwestern Alabama. And it is a place that is nothing but, you know, hills and forests and a few highways bisecting them. And there lives a man named Desmond Spencer. And he is going to be 40 in a few months. And he has worked hard jobs a lot of his life. And he has come to this more or less this crossroads where is he going to apply for disability, something that he doesn't want to do, or is he going to continue looking for and trying to apply for more jobs, something that he has not succeeded in over the last couple of years as he's been turned down at place after place. And he faces these wrenching choices where he has had aches accumulate over the years, His hands go numb. He walks with a fairly pronounced limp. But the question is he disabled? He wonders that often, or is he someone who's just doing this because he needs help and he's out of options? And the story really explores those questions.
And he says this thing that resonated with me. He said the whole world is on disability. And indeed, everyone in his universe is on disability. So his perception is very different from perhaps other people.
This was something that struck him, and strikes him often, but it struck him particularly one night when his family was over for dinner and everyone was grilling out and having a good time, and the questions and the comments and the conversation circulated, as it often does, the topic of health and disability and who is applying for disability, who has disability, who's been denied for their disability application. And he looked around in this moment and he saw that he was surrounded by relatives, many of whom were either on disability or had already applied for disability. And you're right that his universe, he says, wow, the whole world is on disability. And the comment that someone else told him was, well, it's a tough world. And that is really what his world is. It's tough. It's there aren't a lot of options, and a lot of people are on disability.
How much money do you estimate will be paid out to people on disability by the government, by the federal government?
This year, the government is expected to spend $192 billion on federal payment, transfer payments to folks who are on disability. And this is an amount that is more than the combined total of welfare, of food stamps, of housing subsidies, and housing assistance, and unemployment assistance. I mean, this is something that is a huge programs in the United States and affects either directly through these transfer payments or indirectly through people you know, tens of millions of people in the country.
We're talking right now with Terry McCoy. He's a social issues reporter for The Washington Post and has taken a really deep dive into disability benefits and who is taking them in America. Terry, you said that some of the worst places in the country where this is happening is with shrinking populations and few immigrants. Can you explain that?
What's interesting about this is the communities that have the highest rates of disability, they're very correlated to rates of what makes a dynamic community and what doesn't. Where are the areas of dynamism? And an area of dynamism often tracks immigrants. And there's oftentimes this coming and going of people. You know, that's what makes a healthy economy, what makes a healthy place, this coming and going of people. But in these communities, what's happening is they're almost just losing residents. Communities that have lost at least 3% of their population in the last decade or so had some of the sharpest increases in rates of disability. And that's really indicative of a place that just doesn't have much dynamism. There's not a lot of creativity. There's not a lot of jobs that are occurring in these places. And that is reflected in the disability rates.
And in the course of your investigation, you also spoke with experts who are looking into this. What did they have to tell you?
Well, experts are pretty divided on this issue. It's become very politicized. It's very controversial. It's very contested as to what is driving these increases in disability. There is many people who say it is. Everyone says a lot of it has to do with just this population bulge of baby boomers. There are just more people in America today who are aged 50 to 64 than there were 25 years ago, thanks to the outsized presence of baby boomers in the American population. Another reason is the fact that there's just a lot more women in the workforce now than there once were, which creates more people who are on the disability rolls. And another situation is how the economy and how does jobs play into this, and whether or not in instances in which people are out of options, this is something that they try to apply for and turn to. And you see that those trends possibly most pronounced in places in which there is lesser educated individuals and a manufacturing-based economy. Both of these things then come together to create a situation in which more people are applying for disability.
Have you kept in touch with Desmond Spencer? Because when I was reading your article, I really wondered whether he followed through and kept his meeting with Social Security.
Well, Desmond is someone who he is what was interesting to me was the fact that Desmond is as, you know, as honestly as a nice a guy as he can find. I mean, he's someone who is always caring for his family, someone who kind of goes above and beyond as far as trying to take care of what his family needs as best as he can't help out much monetarily. But he helps out, you know, through being able to run errands and being one of the few able-bodied people in the house. And but at the same time, he's someone who's profoundly disconnected from mainstream culture, and the fact that he has never been on a computer in his life. He doesn't have Facebook. He doesn't know how to work a computer. He said if he gets on a computer, it'd scare him half to death. Mm. So the fact is that someone with that sort of you know, his skills today. It makes him much more difficult for him to be able to find a job. So I sent him an article in the mail because I don't think he probably would have read it online.
What do you hope to do next with this project as we wrap up here?
Well, what we're hoping to do next with this project is we're going to be looking at disability, how it affects rural Americans through a lot of different ways, how it affects economies, how it affects cultures, how it affects politics. And how it affects just, you know, generationally. This, and we're working on a story right now about how disability can become generational, passed down from grandparents to their kids to their kids' kids. And you see these patterns in some of these communities where it's a generational thing. And this next story is going to be exploring that phenomenon.
Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you.
Terry McCoy is a social issues reporter for The Washington Post, and he recently published an article called Disabled or Just Desperate, which looks at why people in rural areas have been turning to disability in recent years. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any regular summer activities that you're just itching to get to? What do you look forward to? Are you an outdoor sports person, or maybe you play sports? Tell us what you're looking forward to this summer, and especially tell us what we should see in your town or region. Kate is a relatively recent transplant to Wisconsin.
Yes, I'll be taking notes.
So there you go. And especially if there are fun things for kids to do. What do you do to keep the kids occupied when they're out of school? What festivals are going on in your area? Give us a call right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
For many years, Sagacious Levingston felt like she was faking motherhood. The women she knew looked nothing like the mothers in books and on TV, and she felt like she was constantly failing to live up to what other people thought she should be. Rather than keep trying to change, though, Levingston decided to change the story with a group she called Infamous Mothers.
I've come from four generations of sex workers. My great-grandma was a sex worker. My grandma was a sex worker. My dad was part of the sex industry. My sister was part of the sex industry. I knew that that wasn't for me, but I still found myself engaging in risky behavior, and I was having all of these children, and I didn't have the self-esteem to protect myself because I felt like, well, if I do this, then this person's not going to want to be with me, then I can't get the validation that I need, then I can't go through the world being smart because I have to get the validation first, then I can be smart, right? So there was this whole process that I was trying to go through, and I had to overcome that. One day I had to wake up and say, I have this string of kids. And, you know, when you mess up one kid, you can blame the kid. The kid was a fluke, right? But if you mess up five, folks are like, who is your mama? Who did this? And unleash these folks into the world, right? So I looked up and I had all of this responsibility and I had to do something about it. I didn't see stories like mine. You know, one of the things that I say a lot is that I found myself and women like me amputating parts of myself, ourselves, to fit into these neat boxes. And after a while, you cut off enough pieces, there's just nothing left. When I started this research, I was interested in all mothers, right? And I'm still interested in all moms. But what I noticed was the women who were damaged most by the mothering narratives were moms like me, moms who had come from impoverished Black backgrounds, moms who had multiple children by multiple men, moms who were teen moms or moms who were on drugs. So any mom that I can imagine was in my community was the ones who were really damaged by the mothering narrative. So I knew that if I could help empower that group of mom, it would kind of trickle up. I grew up around amazing women, amazingly. Oh, God, I'm about to cry just thinking about these women. Where I come from, women on the south side of Chicago, women in low-income housing. What I experienced with moms who were tough. Tough was their love. Tough was their form of love. Their mothering met the intensity of that environment. So my name is interesting, right? My mom has a college degree. My dad, who has no college degree, used to read the dictionary, and he named me Sagacious. And I asked my dad, why did you name me Sagacious? Because I'm the only one in my I have 11 other siblings. Their names are like Chandra, Sean, Kyle, Paul, Isaac, right? I'm the only Sagacious, right? So why me? And my dad said, because I wanted you to live up to your name. That was important to me. And so as time went on, when I became an adult, I said, Dad, there's a word right across from my name, Salacious. You know, one letter different, it would have been the pole for me, Dad. I would have been right there swinging on the pole, right? And here I am at the podium, right? Like, that was one letter different. And then I realized that he understood that, and that name was very intentional. By the time he got to me, he was saying, enough. There's something that's happening in our family. And if I call you something different, if I call you wise every day, then maybe you arise. There's something really humbling when you carve out a space for yourself and then other women say, this fits me too.
Sagacious Levingston is the founder of Infamous Mothers. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Erica Janik.
And now Central Time is doing a roundtable discussion, a brainstorm, if you will, of summer activities that you look forward to. Are you an outdoor sports person? What do you do during the summer to keep the kids occupied when they're out of school? That's the question. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And joining us in the studio is Central Time producer Amanda Magnus, who is all about summer, as I recall. Amanda, what's on your list?
Well, one of my favorite things to do here in Madison, Wisconsin, is to bike. It doesn't get too hot here in Wisconsin. Of course, I'm from Maryland, so my metrics are a little bit different than people who are from here. I love bike riding. My boyfriend has already put air in his tires and gone for a couple rides around just to take in some of the warmer days we've had. I'm also really getting into running outside. There are a lot of really nice trails, a lot of really cool nature around here specifically, but I know statewide. We're also really into camping. Kate, I know you're new to Wisconsin. I don't know if you're a camper, but it's big here.
But I definitely getting out to the parks, and I know I did, starting in January, a whole lot of exploration about summer camps available to kids, because I had to make sure my kids were on the first on the waiting list.
I hear those fill up fast.
And I was very pleased to find such a diverse variety of summer camp options, and we had summer camp squared away in early March.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And we want to hear from all of you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are you looking forward to? Summer in Wisconsin is such a gift. After we go through, you know, this wasn't the worst winter, but we go through winter and we want to hear, what are you looking forward to? What's on your calendar? What do you hope to get on your calendar? 800-642-1234. Going back to your biking, Amanda, we actually just bought a bike rack for the first time because we could only ever go as far as we could pedal, which a little shorter for me. So now we can actually get somewhere and then start pedaling. So I'm super excited about that. I know there's some really great state and county parks to go biking around.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to that.
Judith, I know that you're into gardening. Have you started planting anything yet, or is it too early?
So I'm doing fall cleanup right now that, okay. that should have been done last year. I always tell myself it's good for the wildlife that I leave all that, you know, debris around for them to, you know, sit on, hide under. So I actually did put some lettuce seeds and some radish seeds in the ground, maybe a little early, but I just had to do it. A few things, like my herbs are coming up already because they're right next to the they're right next to the house, so I think it's a little warmer. So I'm already starting, you know, I don't want to decimate the crop yet, but I'm starting to use little leaves here and there, and my rhubarb is up. That's really exciting. So yeah, it's an exciting time in the garden. You can kind of forget about all of the past failures and think this is the year.
Fresh start,
exactly. We also have our board operator, Dean Canetter, here, who is a lifelong Wisconsin tonight.
Yes, hello.
The only one in the room. And wow. So we want to hear from you. What do you love doing in the summer?
Well, I am going to find myself on the golf course, I believe. I can't promise that it's going to be pretty once I get out there, but I definitely want to spend some time golfing, and Wisconsin is a great place to be for that. Despite the climate, I think we're one of the biggest golf states in the whole country.
Wow.
Last I heard, we had, I think, the number three golfers per capita in the whole country.
Really? I had no idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of good courses, a lot of great deals.
Courses are already open. I've seen golfers out there.
I was home this weekend. I was hitting some balls into the woods in the backyard getting ready.
Well, and it's actually funny because I know some golf courses in Wisconsin are cross-country ski courses in the winter.
Sure.
And literally, because Wisconsin weather can be so extreme, it goes from cross-country skiing one weekend to it's open for golfing the next.
I think because of the climate, we really cherish it when the summer does come around. So we hit it hard when the summer rolls.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. So, Kate, what kind of stuff are you looking forward to checking out this year?
Lots of good swimming. Mm-hmm. Summer and swimming. And we hit Madison last year right in the nice time of June and had some really wonderful days outside and letting the kids swim, which is always a great way to tire them out.
Yeah.
So,
and get them hungry, as I recall from
hungry,
being a kid.
Get them tired. Swimming is all about summer.
All right. Well, we hope you have a great summer and that it includes listening to Central Time.